Stove Vibrancy. StoveVibrancy.com.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in-depth with the most interesting innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 VBSR members.
Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Last night, at a ceremony at the Echo Center in Burlington, the Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility honored one of its best. The Terry Eric Award for Excellence and Social Responsibility is given annually to a person exemplifying Terry Eric's sustained commitment to the environment, workplace, progressive public policy, and community. Terry Eric was the head of Hemmings Motor News. The recipient of the 2013 award was Jan Blomstrand, the president and CEO of Renewable NRG Systems, which until a month ago you may have just known of as NRG Systems. It has tweaked its name a little. We'll be spending the hour with Jan here on this week's Vermont Conversation, but first, a little background. Since 2004, Jan Blomstrand has served as the president and CEO of Renewable Energy Systems, which is a manufacturer of measurement equipment and turbine optimization systems for the wind and solar energy industries. She joined the company in 1987 when the wind industry was in its infancy and helped build a global organization that now serves 159 countries around the world. Her focus on workplace excellence and sustainability has created an organization recognized by the Wall Street Journal, Best Places to Work, the Vermont Governor's Office, the U.S. Green Building Council, and last year she was awarded the White House, recognized her as a champion of change for renewable energy. Well, welcome to the Vermont Conversation, Jan.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to be a business person. Was this a trajectory in your life that had been set early?
No, absolutely not. As I said last night at the award dinner, I'm probably about the most unlikely CEO of a wind energy company out there. I got my start in nursing. I got two degrees from the University of Vermont, and one in nursing and one in human development, and started off working in women's health and child care, and thought that was going to be my trajectory, and then ended up entering the company that my ex-husband had founded in 1982, and I had helped to, you know, get off the ground, and was 5 years old, and decided to leave nursing and join. We had an infant daughter at the time, and was juggling all kinds of things, and wasn't particularly happy in the job that I was in, and decided, what the heck, I might as well try something new, and never looked back.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Enfield, Connecticut, a bedroom town of Hartford. My father was a design engineer with Hamilton Standard, working on the Apollo space program, and just a small, you know, rural residential community.
And what was the road that led you to Vermont?
Oh, it was UVM. Yeah, I was looking to... I knew I wanted to leave and venture out somewhere else, and looked around at some interesting universities and ended up at UVM.
So, nursing was your... Mm-hmm. Did you go through the UVM nursing program as well?
I did, yeah.
And so when your former husband starts a renewable energy company, you're continuing in your line of work, which is being a nurse. Where did you work as a nurse?
I worked at what was then called University Health Center, the Obstetrics and Gynecology Office, so women's health. I also was one of the initial caregivers at the Otter Creek Child Care Center. That was a short stint that I did before I went back to the OBGYN office. And then I worked up at Fletcher Allen on both the medical floor, and I think I did a little bit of work on the postpartum floor as well.
Yeah. So how did the conversation even come up in your family that you would leave nursing to do something completely different?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I was juggling a lot. We had an infant daughter. I was working at the hospital at the time, so I was working evenings 1 week on and 1 week off, and never really quite wanted to do inpatient healthcare. I was much more interested in outpatient, but that's where I found myself doing that. So I wasn't particularly happy, and the business was growing, and it was clear that it was going to do something. It was still tiny at the time, but it was going to do something, and it needed to start increasing its sophistication. And so my ex-husband and I talked about it and said, why not give it a try? And so I literally got the shoebox full of invoices and the what was called and then a dome book, which was a cash way of taking, you know, care of your finances, not at all sophisticated, and turned that into a computerized accounting system and started from there. And so made this switch from healthcare to business, kind of, what's the word? Serendipitously, I guess.
So did you just teach yourself accounting?
A little bit, yeah. At first I did. Learned what the new computerized accounting systems had to offer, and then decided I needed to learn a little bit more, so I enrolled in some courses at Champlain College and took some 7 a.m. classes before the kids were, they were pretty small at the time, so I could get out of the house pretty early, and took some cost accounting and all kinds of things to get
myself started. This was not just balancing the family books. I mean, you're managing a growing business.
Yeah.
The stakes are high.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that learning accounting on the fly, did you feel like you were right on the edge sometimes of what you actually knew how to do?
Well, sure. But at the same time, the stakes didn't feel high because the company was small. You know, there wasn't, we had maybe 5 employees at the most. So it was small, it was growing for sure, but you could afford to make mistakes when a company's that small. So I never really felt that on the edge. I certainly felt like I didn't know what I was doing. And it was an education by fire. And I remember sitting in my office one time saying, well, how do you set up an accounts payable system? You know, people have been doing this for 100 years. There must be a book out there that tells me how to do it. And it turns out there really isn't a manual, a how-to. So you have to learn and go to college, actually.
Remind people, this is the before the days of QuickBooks and,
yes,
and the various things that can walk you through these things.
Yeah, this was really on the cusp of, the old spreadsheet programs, basically, and certainly everything in computer was the DOS programming. And you had to know a little bit about how to navigate around a computer, more difficult than it is today.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with Jan Blondstrand, President and CEO of Renewable Energy Systems. You can join the conversation by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So nowadays we think of NRG Systems as, you know, a pretty big company on the landscape of Vermont businesses, but what was it when it began? You're describing it as a small business, so how small?
When it began?
Yeah.
When it began, it was nothing. It was really bootstrapped by a $500 investment back in 1982. It was during a period of time when the wind industry was completely in its infancy. It was quite experimental. If you've ever been out to California and you've been to the Altamont Pass and you see the just fields and fields of thousands and thousands of wind turbines, that was the beginning of the wind industry here in the U.S. It's pretty dated technology now, and it's being repowered, of course, but that was where the action was happening, and I wasn't that interested in wind power at the time, but of course my ex-husband was, and this was a dream of his to get this thing off the ground, and saw a niche out there for measuring the wind to see where to put the wind turbines in. That was not something that was sophisticated at all, and so that was the niche the company went after.
And explain what NRG Systems does.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're in our 31st year of doing business and have always been dedicated to wind energy until of late. And the traditional product line was just what I said, the equipment to measure the wind. So if you've got a piece of land and you're looking to see how hard the wind blows and whether there's enough power in the wind to make a good investment by putting in some turbines, you would buy our equipment. And that line was traditionally a tower. They got bigger and bigger over time, so starting off at 10 meters, and now the state of the art these days is either 60 meters or 80 meters, so increasing that size over time. And a data logger and a bunch of sensors. So the sensors would go up on the tower, and the data logger would collect the data from there and put it into some software, and off you go with your data to see what that site looks like. That's the traditional product line. We've now ventured further afield from that, but we still do that.
So it's the whole setup, soup to nuts, of something that measures wind speed and something that records it and measures it.
Exactly. We had a product line, we still do, actually called a Now system, and the concept there is we'll give you everything that you need to measure your wind at your particular site, so you can come to us for everything and put the equipment out there. Yeah.
What was the vision in those early days of wind? Was it that people would have little windmills in their yard? I mean, now we see these industrial turbines. It's obviously not a backyard thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it when you began in the early 80s?
Well, I would say it was much more blurry at that point in time because the technology was not very sophisticated. So what would be considered a backyard or home or residential size wind turbine, maybe a 10-kilowatt turbine, was pretty close to state-of-the-art for a commercial size turbine. So maybe it was a 25-kilowatt turbine that you would use to integrate into the grid. So there wasn't a whole lot of distinction between the different areas of what you would do. Today, you've got still the 10-kilowatt turbines that you'll put in your backyard, but the ones that are connected to the grid are 2, 3, even 5, 6 megawatts now. They're just completely different technology, and so there's a much bigger distinction between the two. So I guess you asked me what the vision was. I think back in the 80s and 90s, it was simply building an industry and building a technology that would work to generate electricity. Today, of course, it's very mainstream. It's proven, it's mature, it's happening all over the world. But back then, it wasn't clear whether there was going to be a real future for wind in our power mix.
Is the idea of the early days of backyard wind, is that still done, or has it really just gone completely over to the industrial scale?
No, it's still done. It's still done, and there's still a line of turbines out there that don't have to be connected to the grid at all. You can use a battery bank if you want to and be completely off the grid. So it's done. It just hasn't become the big market that the industrial scale turbines have.
And you chose to, or NRG chose to, limit itself to the data measuring side of things. Did it ever... Did you ever look into, building the turbines themselves?
Not really. No. The company was formed to do the wind measurement, and that's been the dedication all along. And it there was really not a need to look further from that. There was such a need for our product line throughout the world that it sustained us for the first 25 years without a problem. There was just plenty of business to be had at that time.
What was the these things seem to occur in leaps. What was the leap moment in the NRG story where it went from a small company in Vermont to, as we mentioned earlier, it's now in 159 countries?
That's right.
Was there a moment of a kind of quantum jump?
I would say there were maybe several jumps. So there was a period, I think it was the post-Carter years, when a lot of the initial momentum in the States kind of dried up, and so we made the decision to start exporting, and that made a big difference in our trajectory. So learning how to do that, becoming good at it, and figuring out that there's a wind industry around the world made a big difference for us. So we've been exporting for 20, 25 years, and that made a big difference. And then I would say it was in the early 90s that the whole U.S. wind industry just started to take off. It started to just happen more than just in California, the middle part of the states, and just, you know, the Windy region started to get active, and we were there. We were in a leadership position. Our equipment was well regarded, and we became the leader, and it just took off.
Talk a little bit about the role of wind in our energy mix. Governor Shumlin has talked about having renewables be, well, you tell me, what part of the energy mix? It's a big part, at least half.
It's huge. I'm trying to remember what it could be, like 90.
90, that's
like
what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I was hesitant to wing it with that number.
Yeah.
So 90% by 2030 is what sticks in my mind.
Yeah, sorry, I should know this, but I think you're right.
Well, we should both know this. So that seems like a wildly optimistic number. Tell me, where does wind fit in right now, and where do you see it being part of the mix?
Okay, so if it's all right, I'm going to bring it out to the national level. So the vision from the Department of Energy has been 20% nationally by 2030.
Of renewables.
Of wind.
Wind.
Of wind. Wind is somewhere between 3 and 4% of our electricity mix nationwide. So that's where we stand. And it wasn't that long ago that it was less than 1%. So that 1 to 4 has happened in a fairly short period of time. The trajectory was there to meet 20% by 2030. Things have slowed down a little bit, but we can still easily do it. From a resource perspective, there's no question that our country could have at least 20% wind in its electricity mix. Here in Vermont, the wind resource is there. There's no question that we could have as much as what the governor is proposing. The question is whether we'll do it, whether we'll accept it, and whether it will make it happen.
Right.
Right.
We are talking to Jan Blomstrand, the president and CEO of Renewable NRG Systems, based in Hinesburg, but operating around the world. Let's talk about some of the headwinds, to use a phrase, mm-hmm. that wind energy has run into right here in our own backyard. At this point, it's common knowledge, the kind of resistance that new wind placements have faced when proposed in places like Lowell and elsewhere. First of all, did that surprise you, as somebody who's been in the wind business, to encounter that kind of opposition?
No, it didn't surprise me. There's been opposition as long as I've been involved in this, and some of the arguments are the same regardless of where you are. And you very often hear people say, well, I'm very supportive of renewables, but just not here. That's a very typical response. And is, you know, some of the concerns that you hear, you know, the visual one is, you're not, it's hard to argue. If someone doesn't want to see one, they don't want to see the one, and you're not going to change their mind. It's a matter of putting it into context and looking at what we want for energy. But no, I wasn't surprised by the opposition. I guess some of the tenor of the conversation is a little surprising. You know, the vehemence that comes out of it, and the just how strongly people do feel, you know, you kind of wonder where does that really come from. And it concerns me that it's happening here in Vermont, because we talk about ourselves as progressive and environmental and caring about air quality and water quality and everything else. And wind is a very good choice when you're looking at those things. So it's a little concerning that the opposition is as strong as it is.
But. One of the criticisms that we've heard here in Vermont is the idea that, well, wind is fine when it's, you know, out in the Midwest in the big open prairie, mm-hmm. but when you're talking about a compact state where the turbines have to go on ridge tops, this is just not the place mm-hmm. for siting wind energy, mm-hmm. and some of the other criticisms, it doesn't generate enough power to justify the environmental impact. How do you respond to some of these criticisms that we're hearing locally?
Well, I guess the first thing that I would say is wind development is happening in the middle part of the country in the wide open fields, and it's happening on a very large scale, and there's pretty good acceptance out there for these projects. Not complete acceptance. There's some opposition out there too, but it is happening. And I think when we're looking at where we're going with our energy future, we have to look at what we can do in the location that we're in. And certainly we're not going to have the 200, 300, 500 megawatt farms that you're going to see out in Texas and the plains. That's just not going to be appropriate for here. But we can have wind here, and we can do it in a way that mixes in with our landscape on a different kind of a scale. So it needs to happen if we want to change to any kind of renewable energy future, and we have to figure out what's right for our state.
What do you think is right for our state?
Well, we've got a huge challenge coming up with Vermont Yankee going offline, and where is our power going to come from? And I think that, you know, we certainly don't want to be buying our power on the spot market. So we've got to have a good plan, and we've got to figure it out. And I think wind, solar, all of the renewables should be a healthy part of our mix to fill that gap.
In terms of wind and solar, which is going to have, obviously there's going to be a mix of the two, but which has more potential to, you know, basically be the big renewable player in the energy mix, both here and nationally?
Well, it's a good question. I have to say it's both. And I think, you know, first of all, from a solar perspective, I'm not sure why we don't have solar hot water on every roof possible. When you look at what could be done and what is happening, it's surprising to me that we don't do more. It's simple. It's not expensive. It could be happening. You know, I go to, this is not Vermont, but I go to cities and you look at rooftops and you wonder, why aren't we using them more than we are? So I think from a hot water perspective, we could be doing a heck of a lot more than we are. I hate to play off the two technologies in this discussion, because I think they're both important and they both need to happen. And they're just going to have different siting requirements, and there's going to be a different mix depending on what's appropriate for the place.
The closest, what is the biggest wind operation closest to here? We know there's Cape Wind out in the ocean of the Cape. There's the big turbine farms across the Lake Champlain in New York. Give us a sense of what we're seeing and what those actually generate. Like, for example, those upstate New York turbines. And those, that's as close as I've seen in this area to the California scale, which I've also seen, which is quite a thing to behold, drive on the highway and see for as far as the eye can see these slowly moving white scarecrows, as they seem to be marching off. So what are we seeing around here?
I'm not sure I'm exactly understanding your question. Ask it a different way.
The biggest wind operations in the Northeast are where?
Oh, just where you said. Well, first of all, Cape Wind's not built yet, right? So it'll be coming in the next couple of years, and I think Jim Gordon needs to be given an award for the most tenacious person on Earth to be still trying to get this project landed after how many years he's been working on it. And it will happen, but it's not there yet. When it does happen, my understanding, and I could be corrected on this, is that it's going to provide a significant amount of the electricity for the Cape, as much as 75% of what it its requirements are. So it's going to be...
How many turbines is it?
I don't know. I would have to look that up.
And these are for listeners who explain what Cape Wind will be. I mean, they're sited in the ocean.
It may or may not be the first offshore wind development project in the United States. It's certainly been the longest running in terms of permitting and trying to get it off the ground, in the water, excuse me. It's possible that it might not be the first one. There are a couple of other projects that are in the permitting stages right now that may actually leapfrog it and get in operation sooner. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. It will happen. It will be off the Nantucket shore, about 5 miles off of there, and it will generate the power for the Cape.
What is involved in getting a turbine set on the ocean floor?
Yeah, well, I'm not a constructor, so I really can't tell you exactly how you do it, but this is one of the issues with as turbines get bigger, you certainly want the big ones out in the ocean. You want to be generating as much power as you can from a single turbine. And as the turbines get bigger and bigger and it gets harder and harder to move them across the land, you start to think about putting them offshore because it's much easier for them to move around. You want the offshore wind projects to be in the most shallow water possible so you can put the foundations in, and it's better if you can put them in the bedrock rather than having them floating. But it's quite a challenge. Yeah, and again, I'm not a constructor, so.
Yeah, yeah. So the idea is some of them may actually float?
Yeah, that's possible, yeah.
Wow. And how far off is this? I know, you know, for the backstory that the Kennedy family,
yeah.
Which lives, you know, has a compound in Hyannis, has right. famously fought this to a standstill for many years. What is keeping that from coming online now?
Again, I follow this, you know, a couple times a year, so I don't really know exactly where it is. But it's not that kind of opposition that's preventing it from going in right now. It's more the regulatory process and getting through all the steps that need to be gone through.
Okay, well, we're talking with Jan Blomstrand, President and CEO of Renewable Energy Systems. We'll be back with her in the second half hour of the Vermont Conversation.
Time you saw the light? Think about it. Lighting is the finishing touch for any room, indoors or out. Don't have the thousands of dollars needed for a complete renovation? Why not spend a few hundred at Barry Electric and Lighting and see the difference updated lighting can make? They have all the latest in LED lighting, silent ventilation products, built-in vacuum systems, and lighting controls that turn all of the lights in your home either on or off with one simple touch. Choose from thousands of products all designed to add beauty, function, and convenience to your living environment every day. No need to spend thousands of dollars on a complete renovation. See the light. Come to Barry Electric and Lighting or Illuminations to see all the new products that will make your home truly special for just a little. Barry Electric and Lighting on the Barry Montpelier Road, at barryelectric.com, and at Illuminations, across from the Powerhouse Mall in West Lebanon.
Change can be scary, especially when it involves something as important as healthcare. But Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont provides the security and stability that comes from decades of providing quality coverage. Our team is passionate about service. Our card gives access to care in all 50 states and more than 200 countries worldwide. Still, we're right here in Vermont, making our state a healthier place to live. With all of the changes in healthcare today, one thing remains certain. We'll see you through. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
It's the big, stupendous British Invasion Weekend kickoff block party this Friday night. Starting at 6:30, Stowe's Main Street will be closed off. Dance the night away from 7 till 9:30 with Joey Leone's Chop Shop Band. Marvel at an immaculate showcase of classic British cars. Enjoy the delicious food court on the Village Green. It kicks off the British Invasion, taking place this Saturday and Sunday in Stowe. Don't miss the British Invasion block party this Friday night, Main Street Stowe, presented by Stowe Vibrancy. Stowe Vibrancy.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow.
And the over 1,000 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking this week with Jan Blomstrand, the president and CEO of Renewable Energy Systems. Last night, Jan was feted in Burlington as the recipient of this year's Terry Eric Award for Excellence in Socially Responsible Business. That's given annually by the Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Jan, you've been a pioneer in a variety of ways, one in a field that is pioneering, wind energy, but also as a woman head of a company. You have been the CEO of Energy Systems since 2004, and I guess it's CFO since 87?
That's right.
Tell me some of the unique challenges that women face running a business.
Okay. Well, I'll qualify that with an energy business. So there aren't many of us. So it's a challenge just in being a little bit unique. I think sometimes I'm asked to do things that because I'm a woman and because we need more women at the table. And so I think my phone rings a little bit more asking for invitations than it might otherwise if I was male, just by opportunity, which I'm happy to take when I can, and happy to pave the way for other women. I think there are so few of us that it's harder to get the instant credibility that you might otherwise get by the title of being a leader of a company. You know, I think women need to prove themselves a little bit more still in this day than men do in this kind of an industry, which is so typically dominated by male leaders. So, yeah, I think women have to work a little bit harder. I think we have to move beyond some of the assumptions of what women are capable of and what they want to do and where they want to be in this world. I find it fascinating. I actually enjoy the challenge. I look around the room sometimes and realize that I'm the only woman there, and I say, well, this is okay. This is an interesting position to be in, and sometimes I think it can work in my favor, you know, because I think women do bring a different voice to the table. We do bring a different way of looking at things, and so the quality of the conversation or the things change when the women speak up in the room, and I'm happy to, again, have that opportunity and make that happen. So it's a mixed bag.
Give me an example of that different voice and where you feel like you've provided a different perspective as a woman in a male-dominated industry.
Good question, because anywhere you go with that, you can go into some pretty generalizations, you know, of how people think, and of course everybody's different, and I think I'm trying to think of a good example where, you know, I guess I have to just go to myself, where I'm interested in people and how they connect to each other. I'm interested in process. I'm interested in how we create good connections with each other. So I'm going to go more towards that than I am to the technical, what is it that we're, you know, trying to achieve. And so perhaps I'm not generalizing to all women or that men don't do this, but I might bring something into the conversation of, well, what, you know, what's really going on here, and picking up on the sort of sense of the dynamics in the room and sort of playing that role of let's bring things out on the table versus it being a more blanket, just, you know, here's what it is, here's what it's not. So, things like that. That the research has shown that the voice of women can make a difference, and it's actually not the voice of women, it's the gender balance. That any kind of a work team, a board of directors, it makes better decisions and thinks better and more clearly when there's that mix at the table.
And what does that research say changes when women are at the table than compared to when they're not?
Again, it's sort of this general quality of the conversation. And I think we've all felt this. You know, we know when we're, you know, if you're with a group of guys, and I know when I'm with a group of women, there's a different tenor to the conversation. The conversation is the topics are different. And when you're at a cocktail party or something and there's a group of men and women, it's different. It just changes. It's not better or worse. It's just the thinking is different, the dynamics are different, and somehow, and I don't really know how, that creates better decision making and better thinking.
Do you think that the lack of women in mm-hmm. this field, and that's not unique to the energy field, you know, has there been, do you still see a glass ceiling that, you know, where women check out? And what are the big reasons, whether it's this industry or any, that women, you know, kind of take the side exit? Suddenly those top qualified women just aren't there next year.
Yeah. Well, certainly things are changing. So when I look at, say, the American Wind Energy Association Board of Directors, I have a very dear friend who's been the only woman on the board for probably the first 15 years. There's now four of us, so things are changing. The four women are all CEOs, so we have, you know, broken through, if you will, that glass ceiling. But that's out of a group of 27, so there's still quite a ways to go before that 50-50 gender mix is there. So it is happening. It's happening slowly, and there's a heck of a lot more work to do. In terms of that retention, that's a real problem, and we're finding, particularly in engineering, where the numbers of women are actually decreasing rather than increasing. And when you talk to women about why it is that they drop out of their jobs, what they cite is not what you might think. It's not the, gee, I've got to balance work and family. It's, gee, I don't feel recognized. Gee, I don't feel supported. I don't feel like my work is valued here. It's those kinds of things that are creating a problem with retaining good technical women in their fields.
What about the way that you or perhaps other women have held yourself back? You know, the phenomenon that Sheryl Sandberg describes in, you know, leaning forward, leaning in, mm-hmm. where women will, you know, hold back, or women will stop themselves from pursuing a higher level job, perhaps, you know, due to work-family balance issues. What have you observed in yourself and in others in your company in that regard?
Well, if I go first to my company, what I see is people who really are passionate about their work and care about their work. And when I look at the women there, I think that's the reason they're there. They find meaning in what they're doing, and so they're certainly doing that family juggling, and I certainly see that the stress around the child care, both men and women, it's not just the women that I see it in, but somehow they work it out because they like what they do, and they value having that part of their life as well as their life at home. And so they seem to work it out. In terms of how do women hold themselves back, sure, you know, I think women are much better at deflecting that recognition and taking the attention away from themselves than men are, and I think it works to our detriment. And so we as a gender need to speak more for ourselves and speak up and advocate for ourselves and be willing to accept that recognition that we so dearly want and need to continue on. Yeah.
So now you essentially hold the keys to the kingdom. You run a company. How many employees does NRG have?
78, I think it is today. It changes all the time, but I think it's 78.
So, and you, next year will mark the decade mark of being its CEO.
That's right.
And for listeners who just joined us, we're talking with Jan Blomstrand, the president and CEO of Renewable NRG Systems. So what do you do differently in the way you run your company that's any different from, you know, a conventional energy company headed by a guy?
Hopefully not a lot. I mean, we're a business like any other. We need to create good products. We need to get them out into the marketplace. We need to sell them. We need to manage our resources well. We need to manage our inventory. We need to be a good manufacturer. Those are the things that are important for our business, and I hope I'm running it the way any good leader might. So I don't really see a difference there. The difference I see in my company from run of the mill, and I'm not sure it has to do as much with me as just who we are as a company, is a value to the employees, a value of creating a good workplace. It has been important to me to create a workplace where people want to come to work. They want to be with the people that they're with. Let's face it, we spend a lot of time with our coworkers, and it'd be nice to get along well and have a respectful workplace and an enjoyable place to come every day. And so that's something that I've tried to create over the years, and I think we've been fairly successful at it. So there, I think there's a difference in terms of what you might see in terms of flexible work hours and family-friendly work, you know, practices, and just the conversation in the room. The group of employees that I employ care about what they do. They're passionate about it, and they like to talk about it. And you'll hear it in the kitchen at lunchtime.
Hmm. What does it mean to you to be socially responsible? Your name is certainly associated with, you've just won an award for social responsibility. You're part of an organization, VBSR, and other organizations that tout that. So what's it mean to you, and how does your company reflect that?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I said to the folks at the dinner last night. I think socially responsible business means wanting to do business right, I call it, or better, you know, different, with a passion, with a heart, with an eye towards making a difference in the world. And I think it means caring as much about how you do business as it does about the product that you offer. So, you know, what difference might that be? It's important, very important to me, that as we conduct our business around the world, that we do it with integrity, that we hold a set of values, that we make sure that we're taking care of our customers. I mean, these are things that all businesses should do, but particularly in socially responsible business, you care about that how, that what image do you portray to the world, and how, what do they see, and what can they expect from you when they do business with you.
And when you say we care about our values, tell me about those values.
Well, we've got a set of core values. You know, certainly environmental stewardship is a big part of my company. So, you know, here we are working in the wind industry, creating products to help wind develop, and I want to make sure, and that's very much based in a value of a renewable energy future and a better planet. So as we conduct our business, I want to make sure that we're conducting it in a way that's environmentally friendly as well. So I operate out of two LEED Gold facilities. We produce most of our power on site. We have a high performing workplace. Just trying to do all the things that we can do as a company to lighten our load on the planet and make sure that we're doing operations well. So that's one. I mentioned integrity, making sure that we're conducting business around the world and with the highest standards, and profitability is one of the values that we have. I think you have to be a viable business and a strong business in order to do the good world that you want to do and be a good corporate citizen and give back. Dedication is another value, you know, making sure that we're sticking to what it is that we say that we're good at and what we're doing, and, you know, that's the kind of thing.
We're talking this week with Jan Blomstrand, President and CEO of Renewable NRG Systems, based in Hinesburg, but doing business globally. So what is the hardest thing about being a socially responsible business? A place where you feel like you're trying, but it's just really hard to measure up even to your own standards.
Yeah. I guess I'll answer that in the context of the last year or two, because our business has gone through a downturn. And prior to that, the business was just coming in. It was wonderful, you know, for the first 25 years. The business just came in and things were great. And then that changed. It changed for a lot of reasons, and our revenue went down, and we've been through a much more challenging time. So resources are much tighter. You know, things just have to be a little bit, we have to be a little bit more careful than we used to. So the challenge for me is, how do you maintain that great workplace? How do you maintain that culture, that sense of life is good when things are more challenging? And how do you make sure that the employees are still feeling valued and still enjoying their work when it's just not as easy as it used to be? So how does that sustainable part continue through the ups and downs of business? That's a real challenge for me.
Now, as part of that downturn, NRG had to go through several rounds of layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the company at in this cycle? Is it still in the low part of the dip, or is it are you kind of rebounding and able to? Where is it in that?
Well, we're doing fine. We're a smaller company. We've done the very hard work, and some of the hardest work I've ever had to do in my life to make the company smaller, to adjust to that lower level of revenue, and we've done that. That part is all done. We're looking at a wind industry that's not growing anywhere near as fast as it was before, for all kinds of reasons. So we're looking at slower growth as we do rebound, and we'll be very intentional and very careful going forward as we look at our future. But we're here to stay, and we've got a good plan in place for where we want to go and what we want to offer for products, and we're doing okay.
What has slowed the growth in the wind energy fields?
Well, I could probably spend an hour on that, because there's so many factors, and it depends on where you are in the world. It depends on just who you are in the industry. So here in the U.S., certainly we've got this environment of uncertainty because there's no real energy policy for wind or really any renewable energy source to rely on. So you've got this cycle. I'm sure you've heard this about this production tax credit where, you know, you never know from one year to another. If you're a developer of a project, you don't know whether you're going to have this one simple piece of financing available to you or not. And so what that does is it creates ripples throughout the entire industry. And so one year, if you're a turbine manufacturer, you're just the turbines are flying off your shelves as fast as they can go to meet the developer's needs to get a project in before the expiration of this tax credit. And then the next year, if you're a turbine manufacturer, you have no business because of the uncertainty of where things are going. So in the U.S., what we've got is just kind of a mess of uncertainty and just not good national policy for trying to create a manufacturing sector that requires the ability to plan far ahead. So that's the issue here in the States. Globally, and this actually applies to the States somewhat too, it's kind of an on-again, off-again policy planning mode. So, you know, India will put in an incentive, and then they'll take it away again, and then they'll put it back again. And, of course, you've got natural gas prices being as low as they ever have, and, you know, demand for energy is down, has been since the recession. There's just all kinds of factors. The whole access to capital was a problem after the recession. There's just a whole bunch of things that have just created just a slower development of new sources of energy out there.
What was it like for you as a CEO to have to go through these job reductions?
Like I said, the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Most disappointing aspect of my career. There's probably nothing worse. It's bad on both sides. But to tell somebody that they don't have a job anymore when they're smart and talented and a part of your workforce for a long time and you like them is one of the worst things in the world to have to do.
So where is wind energy hot right now in the world, since you operate in just about every country, it would seem?
Yeah, and it moves around, certainly. But certainly China is a big part of our market. Sizable part. Developing parts of the world are still measuring for wind, so our products are going into India and parts of South America and parts of Africa. Europe is a more mature industry, so there's not as much going on there as there used to be. Canada is actually an active market for us as well. So it's kind of all over, but it changes from year to year.
So if what kinds of people do you, Governor Shumlin has placed this big emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, education. How much does that matter for the people who you are looking for to work at Energy Systems?
You mean from a recruiting point of view?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say at least half of our employees have some sort of a technical degree, and that's what we're looking for when we go out. So, absolutely, it's important to have the most well-trained and intelligent engineers and technical people out there. For us, you know, Vermont Technical College has been a great source of employees for us. Nowadays, we look more nationally because we're looking for more specific skills, but yes, very important.
Has it been difficult to find what you're looking for in Vermont?
Typically not. It depends on the position. There's one position we just hired for where, you know, there was only half a dozen people in the world who had the kinds of skills that we were looking for. So that one was particularly difficult, and we're glad that we've filled it now. But for manufacturing and for entry-level engineering, no, Vermont's a great place to hire.
Your business is just going through a name change. What was NRG Systems is now Renewable Energy Systems, and to the outside world, it may just seem that you just print some new stationery, but I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So tell us, what a a several decade old company, what it's involved in changing your name.
Sure, yeah.
And why you did.
Yeah, this was actually a very enjoyable project for me, and it culminated last month when we unveiled the whole rebranding and the name change and the logo change and everything else. But behind that was about 8 months of really hard work, looking at where we are as a company today, how we're perceived in the world, how we're presenting ourselves, lots and lots of research. We went out and talked to our customers and got about 550 responses. You know, we just asked the question, how do you see our company? What are we doing well? What aren't we doing well? Just did all that market research. And the fact of the matter is, our old identity reflected who we were for the first 25 or so years of our company. The last couple of years, we've branched out beyond that tight niche that we were in of wind resource assessment, and we're in the solar industry. We're developing a line of products for the operating wind turbines, and we've been doing this, but we haven't really updated or freshened the identity to tell the world that that's what we do. So this is what that was all about, was a new facelift, if you will, to show the world who we are today and distinguish ourselves and make sure that people know who we are and what we do. The name change, is renewable energy system. So it tells the world that we're dedicated to renewables, and that's what we're doing. And it also allows us to be about more than just wind. It allows us to go into solar and other forms of renewables if we want to. But it was a big deal. It's a big decision to change a name after that length of time. And we changed the colors. We changed everything. So it's a whole re-identity, reintroducing ourselves.
You and I, just before the show, were talking about art in the workplace. Local artist Sarah Lee Turat is somebody you commissioned at one point to create art for the building. Tell me a little bit about why art matters to you in your workplace.
Well, this came, this was a back in 2003 when we were constructing the first building, and had some discussions around what is this workplace going to look like? We're creating this beautifully designed, high-performing building. Is it going to have white walls? You know, what's it going to look like inside, and how are we going to make it inviting? And decided to actually create some art within the structure. So the first thing we did was we hired Sarah Lee Turat, and she did a number of the projects that are actually embedded in the floor. So they became part of the design of the building, and started to add some beauty into it, and that's how I got to know her at first, and then we took it a little bit further and said, well, now what are we going to put on the walls? And I have a love of art. I'm not an artist myself, but I just love having visual delights around me and in my home and everywhere else, and I have an aversion to some of the artwork that I see in some workplaces and you know, some of the just run-of-the-mill, you see it everywhere kind of thing that's meant to inspire but's actually pretty not inspiring at all. And so I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something different. So what I've got in there, and it's a personal collection, it's mine, is mostly Vermont artists and just an eclectic collection of some interesting things to both provoke and inspire and create something visually appealing.
We have a caller on the line, Xenia from Barrytown. Xenia, welcome to the Vermont Conversation. What's your question for Jan Blonstrom, the CEO of Energy?
I'm wondering if you sell equipment for wind energy to ocean-going ships. I ask because in the early 1970s, I worked on a four-masted barkentine sailboat that had a windmill on the mainmast, and that was one of the things that provided power to the ships, including over the sides anode that fed ions to the hull to keep it from rusting. Do you do anything with ships at sea to help them with their energy needs? Because there's a lot of wind out there.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that we don't produce the turbines themselves. We're making the equipment, and our niche has very much been the large scale projects onshore. So it's not a huge market for us. But with that said, if a ship needed to measure its wind, they certainly could buy our equipment, and they could do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your question. Well, just as we wrap up here, Jan. So, a young woman comes to you. She's just graduated college or grad school and wants to be you, wants to be a leader in the energy field. What would be your advice to her about how to succeed and what mistakes to avoid?
Oh, wow. Big question. But I guess I'll go to my hero, Madeline Kunin, who helped me prepare for the President's Job Summit. And her advice was just show up.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you, Jan Blonstrand, President and CEO of Renewable Energy Systems. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 for our next conversation.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program.
This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. And by National Life Insurance. For more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. And by over 1,000 VBSR members.
You are listening to 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 Barry, AM 550, WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. We still don't know why Aaron Alexis shot and killed 12 people at the Washington Navy Yard Monday before being shot dead in a gun battle with police, but the profile of a man who is mentally ill is coming more clearly into view now. Paranoid, worried.